Hi, I'm blood-sucking goat demon, Megan Rosati.
And I'm Danielle. Hey, therapy is good. Go do therapy. God, everyone, please, therapy, right now. Radford.
Welcome to Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast, a Stage 13 original series that is an immersion into the unique worlds created by each episode of the hit anthology series on the CW and Netflix.
In each episode of our podcast, we sit down with the Two Sentence Horror Stories creators, as well as celebrity guests and social activists, to deep dive into the social and cultural issues explored on the cult series
and the carefully intricate craft that went into the making of each episode.
This is Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast.
Is this what you saw? Huh? Look.
Just let it go already.
Look, its tail gashed the boy's cheek, drawing blood. The blood isn't what fed El Coco. It was the boy's fear, which would one day turn to rage.
That clip you just heard was from the season 3 episode Homecoming. Before we get into Homecoming, Danielle, how are you? And did you get my Chupacabra reference?
Hello. I will always get your Chupacabra reference. I am 99% sure that my cats are Chupacabras, but the kind that don't want to eat you, but just love you with their faces.
How cute. We love that for you.
I love it for me.
So, today we are discussing the episode Homecoming, where three brothers return to their childhood home to visit their dying father, only to be forced to confront the demons of their past.
If you think about dark stuff too much, it becomes real. You gotta stay positive, yeah?
Is that your solution to everything? You just smile?
You can check out this full episode on the CW and on the CW app.
With Homecoming, we'll be discussing the toxicity of family secrets and shame and the legacy of child abuse.
Joining our conversation today, we have two returning guests to the podcast. I'll be chatting with Lisa Morales and Stephanie Adam Santos.
Lisa and Stephanie co-wrote this wonderful episode of the season. I'm so jealous you got to chat with them again.
Yeah, you should be.
I am. Like, super am.
Lisa is the season 3 showrunner who's also written and produced for Queen Sugar. Stephanie has written several episodes of Two Sentence Horror Stories across the seasons, including this season's Plant Life.
Plus, we'll chat with actor and composer Brittany Allen about scoring the season of Two Sentence Horror Stories. Actor and composer, all right, we get it. you're very good at doing everything. I'm super excited. I cannot wait to talk with her about that because, like, literally, I've talked about this. Sound cues are the easiest way to get a Danielle Radford to cry.
We love it. Later in the show, we'll be joined by writer Matthew Rodriguez. Matthew is a senior editor at The Atlantic whose work has appeared in Slate, Teen Vogue, and Remezcla.
We've got another great episode in our hands, if I don't say so myself, and I do, and I will.
I'll say it too. I will say it as well.
Brah, brah, brah. I wish that we had a visual component to this podcast because it's just me doing the brah visual, whatever.
Yeah.
You're a person of color.
Maybe the producers can add in an air horn of excitement.
We've got another great episode. First up, Lisa Morales and Stephanie Adam Santos.
Hi, Lisa and Stephanie. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
So we're really psyched to have you both back to talk about this episode, Homecoming, that closes out the season. So y'all are co-writers on the episode. I first have to gush just a little bit. I think this is low-key one of my favorite episodes. I'll get into why in the other questions. But can you tell us a little bit about how this episode came together?
We had three Latin or Latinx people in the writer's room, and somehow we got into talking about our families and how much toxic masculinity is in our families and the power structures of our families. And that just kind of led to a conversation about, you know, Steffi and I both have relatives that are a little extra, a little misogynistic, sometimes maybe verbally abusive. And we that led to a conversation about, like, we have very strong women in our families as well. And why do we put up with this? this. Like, why does my uncle get a pass or my great uncle get a pass? And even though we all know his behavior is inappropriate and really crosses a line, there was something really interesting. And Daniel, the showrunner's assistant, also, you know, a male, he had the same experience in his family. Like, why do we put up with this behavior? And that led to then, you know, when the magic of the writer's room led to this episode and the conversation that we're having in this episode about complicity, about secrets, family secrets, about toleration of behaviors that are bad for a multitude of reasons. And that's kind of how we, so it's very personal for both of us. We each could, you know, refer to people in our family that are characters in the story.
Before I ask Stephanie her take on it, I have to share this anecdote. So when I went to visit my dad's family in Puerto Rico, we met his tío Carlo, who, when he would get angry, would throw furniture in the lagoon. And if you looked out at the lagoon, you could see like shapes of old lawn chairs like peeking up from the water depending on the day. And it was like, you know, Tio Carlo and his crazy ways. But like, he threw furniture. And there's a way that we use, you know, humor to address these stories that could be scary or painful. And so like, it, the narrative can change depending on your circumstance, right? So Stephanie, how did you relate to the themes in this episode?
Well, first of all, I hope you write that story about Tio Carlo.
I'm still waiting for the moment to put Tio Carlo in.
That's fantastic.
The lake monster, I can already see it. But I think maybe before we even got to the themes that Lisa was talking about, there was this idea of a monster that is experienced in the present that is a monster that was experienced in childhood. So there was this kind of primordial idea of a monster that hasn't gone away. And that kind of helped us, it kind of helped unearth those themes about, you know, generational trauma and secrecy and the things that we kind of keep suppressed. So, and that's also, usually it's, I think for me with horror, that's kind of where things start to bubble up, right? It's like with the image, with the monster, then that starts to kind of, you know, boil up some images in the old cauldron.
You know, that's really interesting hearing Stephanie talk, and it reminded me how different writers come at stories in different manners. Stephanie is a horror head. She's an expert when it comes to this genre. So I love that she came into it via a monster versus I'm coming in from personal experience and from a character way. And, you know, again, that's the magic of the writer's room. And when you're lucky enough to put together a room of writers from different point of views or different methods as to how they approach story, it's a perfect example right there between the two of us.
Yeah, I love that. And I have a few more questions about El Coco or Cocuy as that figure has been known. But I want to talk about, so you both are women, right? And yet this episode centers male characters. It has three brothers and a dad, and there is a Tia, but she's really not the narrative focus. So what made you decide to make that choice, and what creative possibilities did that choice open up for you in terms of the story?
I mean, you know, we had an all-female writer's room, and we were very conscious to make sure that when we were approaching certain stories, there's two stories this season, two episodes this season, Toxic and Homecoming, that have an all-male cast, primarily an all-male cast. So it's really important to, when we're approaching that story, to have to be very balanced and to check ourselves. If we start going a little too, you know, negative in one direction, that we hold ourselves accountable. But there is a sensitivity that I think as women, we might bring to the story that's a different angle of it. You know, for me, it was a niece watching my uncles behave badly. And I pretty much took that perspective into the story when breaking these characters down and showed it from my point of view. This is what I experienced. This is what I saw only in this particular case. Axel's kind of my hero because he's actually confronting it. We sat around silently and continued to let it happen because our mothers and our aunts don't want us to confront it. So that's my way into it.
Gotcha.
I think that's really good. And I think you're right that it could have been, you know, it could have been women, it could have been cis women, it could have been non-binary characters, but because we chose, you know, three cis male brothers, it took on, you know, a certain flavor that comes with those types of repressions or the way they might deal with each other.
Well, and I think especially within the sometimes hyper masculine culture of a lot of, you know, Latino men, there is this idea, you know, we talked about this on a previous podcast, that you look to the examples of masculinity that you were raised with, right? And I think that for straight cis men, that like is the heaviest embodiment of that experience, right? Because when your identity aligns with what you see, it's sort of harder to question it. Whereas I feel like if you're queer or a woman, you see the ways that that identity doesn't serve those people and the people around them.
Especially with anger as something that we kind of came to, is that, you know, that's outbursts of anger is kind of very specific to, you know, a cis male way of dealing with repressed trauma.
Yeah, in this particular family, you know, they're allowed to, they tolerate bad behavior in regards to rage, but they don't tolerate behavior in regards to sensitivity or pain or sadness. Uh-huh. The language that they have, that they use to express themselves, those negative emotions is, you know, is anger, you know, more masculine, historically speaking, a more masculine emotion. That was also near and dear to me because, you know, I come from a family that we're much more apt to have a temper tantrum than we are to say, I'm sad or I need help. That is not, doesn't seem to be in my family's vocabulary. I mean, certainly in the younger generation, you know, we've gone to therapy, we've dealt with it, we've addressed it so that we have a bigger rainbow of choices here when it comes to emotion.
Right.
But certainly, you know, those more sensitive emotions aren't necessarily always appreciated or tolerated in traditional Latin families.
You know, although this episode is centered on the Latino experience, the idea of men not feeling safe to show vulnerability, I think, is something that many people experience in American culture, right? Like Western American culture, we're not known for, you know, remember when metrosexual was like a thing, like men who showered and like put gel in their hair, they were like, it's almost gay, but not. Like that is such a crazy concept that we accepted as the culture for a while. This was 20 years ago for the kids, but like, that's our discomfort with holding these different identity facets. Mm-hmm. So I just loved how you explored that. I found this very emotional. I kind of cried when I talked about it to the producers because of the like the way that trauma was expressed. Yeah, and like one thing that really hit, so spoilers, but the youngest son, Axel, right, he's our protagonist, returns to his family's home, and he immediately begins to be tormented by an evil force that seems to be attached to his ailing father. So it's jarring for him, but nobody else thinks it's real. So why did you decide to have his family not believe him and have him be the only one to see the monster?
I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons why the brothers refused to, you know, to listen to him. One, and it was important to the story that we set it up this way, Axel's an unreliable narrator. You know, he has a history of drug abuse, that he basically got involved with alcohol and drugs to quench his pain, to numb his pain as he was growing up. That's how he learned to deal with this abuse that was happening to him. That was surreal. Like, is he imagining or is it real? So that's the first reason, the unreliable narrator. And the second thing is that everyone in that family has benefited from their father's success. The father's success is predicated on these stories that he's writing of his childhood. I mean, he's using the villain that tortured him as a way to then parlay that into this amazing Stephen King kind of career. So, you know, and the sons also have benefited, not so much Axel, but the, you know, Dante, the eldest, is a inspiring horror writer. If you expose that this family has made a deal with the devil, so to speak, it all comes crashing down. One, the father could be seen as, you know, mentally unstable, like, come on, this really happened, and all of a sudden this gravy train stops. You know, they all have something to lose by addressing the truth and pointing fingers to your father, which again, in the Latin culture, we respect our elders. You know, you're going to be discrediting your father, you're going to be setting him up to be known as an abuser, and now the family loses prestige. So shame is a big factor in this story.
Yeah. I loved that. And I also, you just said something that I thought really hard during the episode and have to mention now, which is the, you know, Latino Stephen King. I was like, yes. Like what? Like, yes. Can that guy be real? Can he exist? Oh, his son is also a successful author. I was like, where is this book? How can I buy it? Can I put it, you know,
I don't know if the guy's going to be real, but the female might be real. Stephanie Adams Santos.
Well, I was going to say Stephanie Adams Santos. Can you think of a Latino Stephen King or Latina Stephen King that is working right now? Who's, work inspires you? I mean, besides yourself, obviously, but I feel like there's, you know, Silvia Moreno Garcia is one of my personal favorites, but are there other people out there that like you can throw out if we want to search out a Latino Stephen King vibe?
I don't know if Stephen King is the exact right comp, but Carmen Maria Machado is someone I really love, and she's queer as well. And she's just such a horror head, but also, you know, she wrote that memoir in the Dream House, which is not horror, but still has that, you know, that mythic essence and horror essence. So I feel like when she could fill that space for me. But I did want to say one thing really quick about what we were talking about before. There's something else too that we wanted to dramatize about the resistance to change and how, you know, that element of gaslighting and, you know, change can be really scary and violent. And you see for the family, they have all this wealth and these things that they've all benefited from the silence of the psychological abuse. And so they all have something at stake. And I was just, you know, as Lisa was talking, I was like, you know, that actually fits really well with kind of where we are as a country right now. This, you know, change and healing can be really scary and violent and require really true sacrifice, you know, as we see like with the wound of slavery. Mm-hmm. And it's not willing to be swept under the rug, and the trauma is still happening, and the monster will live on as long as there are still people or communities who will gaslight or deny that truth or not be willing to do the sacrifice and change that it takes to truly heal.
Yeah.
And so you see these eruptions of anger, you know, the monster, the riots, these like necessary forces of change. So I just wanted to, that felt, I hadn't really realized that before until I heard Lisa talking.
Oh my God, I love that. And I also want to say I appreciated your handling of the Tia in this episode, because she is this force that suppresses the truth, right, and denies Axel's experience. But in the end, we find out she has her own, spoiler alert, monster. And so I was like, man, are we going to throw Abuelita under the bus, or, you know, or throw the Latino woman under the bus? And so I just loved that moment of empathy. So how did you come up with that character, and how does she inform how the brothers deal with their own trauma?
I mean, that character was important to us as we were breaking this episode, that we did not want to throw the Tia under the bus. But at the same time, she is an instrument of complicity. She's watching these boys be, you know, she knows that Axel was hurt, but she also watched her brother be hurt. In the end, the father, while abusive, was also a victim. It was the cycle that continues over and over. Yes. And now Axel is being victimized. The brothers, when you expose the secrets and you bring them into the light, the goal of it was to stop the cycle of abuse that happens in families. Horror, as we all know, is a great engine. It's a great genre for exploring allegory and exploring our deepest fears and using monsters or supernatural elements to kind of represent those fears. That's why we wanted to make sure that while she is complicit and she has guilt here and she has responsibility here, she's part of the cycle. She has seen it. She's been on the sidelines feeling helpless throughout her entire life, and now it's happening again. The mistake that she makes is not standing up to it. The brothers are the ones that were able to find the courage to stand up to it and to finally put the cycle, to destroy the cycle once and for all.
I love that. And before we go, I have to talk about Stephanie, the El Coco Cucuy of it all. Can you tell us a little bit about the origins of this monster and how you made it your own?
Yeah, it's a monster that exists throughout Latin America with different names, different attributes. You know, it's essentially a Latin American boogeyman. And so in some countries it has red eyes or long claws, but what it has in common in every place is that it takes children. And so that's kind of why we were drawn to it. This monster that takes children and is a boogeyman, but now they're facing, you know, that in adulthood. For me, I love the B movie monster at all. I wish we could have seen more of the monster in the episode, like close ups. I love that slime coming down. I want it.
Lisa's like, please no, for the budget reasons. Let's not show it more in close up. I thought it was very chilling, honestly. Like I said, my biggest fear is the closet door is a little bit open. And so in this episode, when you filled it with the kukui, it was like, oh, so scary. All right. Well, Lisa and Stephanie, thank you both so much for joining us and sharing so openly in this conversation. Can you please share any details about what you're up to next?
Well, I've got a pilot that I'm waiting to hear from CBS if they're going to pick it up. Should find out next week. And then just developing, you know, cool and weird and interesting stories on the side. And, you know, that's what I've got going on.
I'm working on a pilot with the Ohalagnishan Lab, but I have a poetry book coming out next year through Orison Books. So that's in another realm. It's called Dream of Xibalba, which is the Mayan word for hell. So a little more horror in the poetry world. I have to hear that.
Thank you so much. We're so excited to see what you're both up to next. Thank you again to Lisa Morales and Stephanie Adams Santos. Well, Danielle, jealous? I had an amazing conversation with Lisa Morales and Stephanie Adams Santos about this hyper emotional, hyper scary episode.
Yeah, I am really super, super jealous. God, I really am so jealous that I missed this. I cannot believe that you got to like talk to Lisa and Stephanie about this episode. It is maybe my favorite episode of the season, possibly one of my favorite episodes of the entire run of this show. I can't wait to hear it. What happened? You got to tell me everything when we get off of mic.
No, you can subscribe to this podcast like everybody else, Danielle.
All right, fine. I will still like and subscribe. Yeah,
it was so fun. Wait and listen to it in the episode. And coming up next, Brittany Allen. Well, Brittany, thank you so much for joining us. It's so great to have you on the show.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yo, okay. So like, obviously we're excited to have you on the show because we want to talk to you about like the way that you do scores, and I have a lot to say. But also, in addition to being a music composer, you're an actor. I'm a huge fan of all my children.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yo. Huge fan of all my children.
I love that.
You won a daytime Emmy. I can't even stand it. Can you talk to me about how you made the transition from acting to being a composer? And also, anything you want to tell me about all my children.
Oh, sure. Okay.
I got to say, before you start talking, Britt, that All My Children was my mother's soap opera. So, cool. You know, there's like One Life to Live, there's General Hospital. We were in All My Children house.
Nice. It was a really special thing to be a part of that show. And one of the things that made it so special was just the love that the fans have for it. And, you know, when I first joined the show, it was shooting in New York as it did for like over 40 years. Mm-hmm. And then while I was on it, they, you know, in an effort to kind of like reduce costs, actually, they moved the show out to LA, mm-hmm. right? This was before, unfortunately, it ended. But that first year of living in New York and going on the subway and like having people run up to you and be like, Marissa, you know, and you, usually it was like, you need to leave JR, you know, like he is not right for you.
They're giving you advice.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I read that in an interview that you did, and you said another thing that I thought was so cool in that interview about how you feel the music in your body in the same way you feel a character's emotions, like you feel that energy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, for me, like acting, I use probably a bunch of different methods to kind of build my own method, but ultimately my goal is to have my heart fully aligned with what the character is experiencing, whether that's using substitution from my own life or just, you know, building a bunch of, using my imagination to build kind of the history of this person and doing like meditations to kind of like
put myself through some of that history, and so that I come with like a lot of feelings inside of me. And it's also, you know, my prep work for acting has always involved music. Like, I'll be the weirdo that's like, you know, telling the AD, like, I'm just in this corner dancing, don't, like, you know, and like sound guys and other tech guys are like walking by and I'm just like, you know, free moving to Alanis Morissette prior to a scene kind of thing. So like, there's a rhythm, a musical rhythm, I think, to, and music has always been something that's like helped me drop into emotions as an actor. So yeah, when I come at composing now, it's similar, but what's different about it that's so cool is like, it's not just me, the actor, interpreting it. Now I'm watching another actor who's already done the interpretation, and I'm basically like doing the same thing where I'm trying to, I'm like, what's my way into this? Like I'm simultaneously, you know, maybe instantly hit with certain things that, that choices that they've made or choices that are in the script that like resonate with my gut and with my heart. And what does that feel like? How does that make me feel? What like, does it make me, you know, close up? Does that make me feel open? Like what are the kind of like, and I won't necessarily be putting it into words, but I'll just be processing it. And that will then be what dictates maybe some of my instincts when I sit at the computer or the piano.
Well, so when you look at something like Inception in the way that they use music, and also I have talked about this a bunch. I almost said famously, but like, I feel like you can only use that word if you are famous. But I talk a lot about how like, it doesn't matter how I feel about a movie or a TV show. If the score is scoring, oh, baby gonna cry.
Yeah. Same here.
Baby gonna cry.
The music hits me. Everything you say, I'm like, oh my God, yes. Oh my God, yes. Like any project, I make a playlist because I'm like, what is the world? What is the world like? And it's so great to hear that as a composer, you put that much thought into it as to like, am I judging them? Let's write it into the song. Like, I love hearing that because it is such a huge part of the emotions for me. So it makes me feel like really happy that you're thinking so hard about it.
Oh yeah. You know, I think, with everything, it can be easy to, you know, find shortcuts, like, you know, as an actor, as a writer who gets really good at writing, like, or as a composer, you can kind of go, okay, I know the short, quick, easy, dirty way to get here. But that is not, that's going to burn you out. That's going to make you so much less inspired by the material. And you're not going to be making the choice that's kind of underneath that will ultimately be more powerful for the audience.
Right. And I think that like when you score, obviously like horror, so much of it is like people like creeping into dark corners and like, the soundtrack tells you what to feel. And so like, let's talk about that. Like, let's talk about like how it works when you score horror, because it's such a, it is a different entity in the same way that I do think that like it fades in, but like I do think that horror and romantic comedies, I think, use music in a way that a lot of other places do not. And specifically your work on Two Sentence Horror Stories, were you always interested in horror?
What I love about working in horror is that you can be really experimental with the sounds that you come up with. I mean, I get to do multiple things that I like. One is that there's these kind of, these characters have these intensely dramatic arcs, right? Where they go to the worst parts of themselves or the worst parts of, you know, the world around them. And so you can really lean into these, that emotional journey and find some great, in some cases it's through like a theme that, you know, just transitions and changes and evolves and goes somewhere really epic by the kind of all is lost moment. Or you're also kind of like, how can I do something different with the horror? How can I, you know, maybe it is strings, but how can I not do the kind of strings that we're all super familiar with? Or maybe it's, you know, something that I started to do now is every time I start a new project, I'm also just like becoming a bit of a gearhead. So I'll like buy a new instrument to, like, that's my justification. I want to try a new sound. I want to both to, for my own, you know, to keep myself interested and engaged, to teach myself something new and to do something that I haven't done before. So lately I've been getting these cool little modular synthesizers. They're very fun. This one's called a EO Wave Quarantine.
Okay, Britt is
Swarm.
Showing.
Have you used that?
Can I say, Britt is amazing. Showing something that looks like a cross between a Ouija board and a lithiometer and a psychic magnet device. So,
exactly. Yes, totally. So you do feel like a bit of a sorcerer, mad scientist.
Have you gotten to use that on any of the episodes on this season?
Two Sentence Horror Stories. I have this other synthesizer called Behringer Neutron, and it's a little bit bigger than this, but same thing in that you can, you know, you plug it in and you just start kind of turning knobs and pressing buttons, and you just, you know, usually what I'll do is prior to really delving in and like scoring a specific scene or trying to crack a theme, I will give myself at least a few days, maybe longer, where I'm just laying down a bunch of sounds, a bunch of ideas. So I'll just kind of like, you know, trip out on these synthesizers for a minute, and until I have minutes and minutes of sounds that then I'll go back, I'll listen to, and I'll kind of isolate, ooh, that's a rad sound. That makes me feel a certain way.
This season, is there a moment that you can think of where you were like, yes, I did it? Or like, oh, this is going to scare so many people.
Every episode is so different from the last, and you know, you in some, like for Teeth, I think we were going for, you know, an 80s synth horror thing. For The Killer Inside, it was more clear that we needed you know, classic piano and strings kind of thing. And then for Toxic, you know, it's these young boys who are at like a kind of electro festival, and so I wanted to really lean into like an electronic sound. So yeah, you know, every episode's different. And I mean, I enjoy each of them for different reasons, but I particularly liked scoring The Killer Inside this year, because I just felt like it had such a beautiful arc. Like it simultaneously had, you know, this great horror, but then there was at its core a very successful kind of heartbreaking drama. It's so sad. And the acting was so great. And I just loved this depiction of this family, you know, giving us a new way of looking at people that we don't always get to see, you know, just being a family and a complicated family, mind you, you know, and as we are. And I loved that score. The show itself, it just felt like a nice balance of the drama and the tension. And
you really got a chance to shine, because there was no dialogue for the first 9 minutes of the episode. Yeah, composed was crucial. So also congratulations to you on that, because that is a heavy load to carry, and you made it look easy. We have to wrap, unfortunately, but please let our audience know what new projects you have in the works that they can look out for, and where else they can follow you and find your work.
I have a film coming out this spring that I scored. It's a film called Torn Hearts, and it's going to be released through Blumhouse. Mm-hmm. And then I just wrapped acting in a new show for Netflix. It's called Grendel. That will be probably a minute before it comes out. And I'm finishing up an album right now, so definitely keep that one on the lookout, because that's the thing. That's my baby.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, you can follow me on the Insta. My tag is Britt Audrey Allen. Britt Audrey Allen.
So. Oh yeah.
That's where I'm most active.
Yo, like we can't even, again, I have said this a million times, sound is such an entry into horror and feelings, and people always neglect how important people who do the work that you do are. So thank you once again to Brittany Allen for joining us today.
Danielle, that was so cool to talk to Brittany Allen. And I got to say that I am here for this moment we're at, where people and women especially can embody two creative identities at the same time. Because I feel like she was talking about a moment in the past where she's like, I was only focusing on acting. And I love that we can acknowledge that you can be a brilliant composer and a brilliant actress at the same time. And it doesn't take away from her other skills, it enhances it. So I love that she's out here being a model for this new kind of empowered creative.
It's funny when you say you, because when you say you, you mean her and not me. I did.
I mean, all of us, girl. It was the royal you.
It was a royal you. Like I can't even. I have been a fan for obviously years, and then it is immeasurably difficult to be able to do this kind of work in a way where, like, literally, and I've said this, that like the job of a composer on a show, on a movie, on anything, their job is to make you feel stuff.
Next up, Matthew Rodriguez. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us on our very last show. How are you?
Oh, I didn't even know that I was going to be like a finale, like a...
Oh yeah, you're the banger ending.
Yeah, the headliner. Oh my gosh. That's awesome. I'm really happy to be here. And I'm so happy to be able to talk about this episode with you.
That's so dope. So Matthew, thank you again so much for coming on with us. But Matthew, you are an award-winning journalist. You've talked about race, gender, queerness, and like a bunch of other like really important stuff for a wide variety of publications. Why is it so important for you to personalize your work and talk about current events through the lens of your identity?
I actually teach a journalism class at NYU, and I talk about this a little bit. And I feel like, you know, there are, working in the media, there's obviously certain ways that media outlets frame stories. And it's really powerful when people can offer an alternative version of what might be the dominant media framing through their own lens. Right. And one thing I talk to people a lot, because, you know, when I talk about identity, I don't only talk about like, you know, I'm speaking as a blank, blank, blank. I also try to speak from a place of lived experience. So, you know, and because what it means to be, let's say, Latino, or what it might mean to be queer, can be two totally radically different things for different people. So, you know, being a journalist and being a writer, I think I'm bringing my personal perspective, but I'm bringing lived experience to it more so than just identity.
I love your delineation between lived experience and identity. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's so, it really captures something very specific. Like, you know, my dad is Puerto Rican, but I grew up in Connecticut and I'm very white looking. So my experience as a Latina is very different than, say, my Afro-Latina friend who has darker hair and speaks, you know, Spanish more fluently than I do. So I think I love that point. But I want to talk to you about the young adult graphic novel you're currently writing, please. Can you give us any intel on the inspo or just a little teaser or anything?
Well, it's semi-autobiographical, and I would just say that it's, you know, comes from a place of lived experience, and it is about a teenage, you know, like, let's say young high school queer Latino person who is also dealing with like their own weight issues, and I would say the issue is that people around them cannot accept them at the weight that they are. And also, like, growing up, I know that there was a feeling for me, because I grew up like watching shows like Queer as Folk in secret at like 12:30 when everyone in my house had fallen asleep, that, you know, I didn't feel like there was any room for fat people in the queer world. Mm. And so the book kind of tackles that theme, is that like everyone feels like there's only one version of queerness that they can be. And often that multiplicity isn't felt. And so this is a person, it's like I said, semi-autobiographical, but it's about a person who's navigating entering the queer world, trying to be who they are.
But I do want to talk about what is going on in Homecoming. What were your initial thoughts about this family in particular when you were watching this episode?
Oh, gosh. So two things. First of all, I think it's super interesting to have watched Homecoming in kind of a post-Encanto world. You know what I mean?
Yeah. This is a good point.
My first thought about it was like, how interesting. I mean, I think obviously for a lot of people, their understanding of Latinx culture is that we are very family oriented. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, everything that happens also happens to your tia mm-hmm. and also happens mm-hmm. to like everyone, you know. So, it was interesting to watch in a post-Encanto world because it's obviously the exact opposite genre. Like there's the sunny musical and then there is the like dark horror. Mm-hmm, So I loved kind of the horror take on what are very similar issues, like secrets in the family, the inability to talk about our secrets, intergenerational difference to how we approach secrets. So that was one thing that was going through my head. And then the other part, just in terms of secrets, it actually reminded me of that saying that's like, you're only as sick as your secrets. You know that saying?
Yes.
They reminded me of that, like the idea that these generational things that people don't talk about end up, you know, it reminds me of a lot of my friends who, you know, my generation, so I'm 32, our millennial generation, like entering therapy and knowing that like our parents didn't go to therapy and then like we have to therapize ourselves and then would also forgive our parents. Like, I think that's something I read that was like a big part of healing and going to therapy is like forgiving your parents and understanding that they might not have had that same access to therapy or anything like that. And like, they are still in that need of healing. And like that relationship between the main character and his father kind of reminded me of that kind of maxim or that understanding.
Yeah. The intergenerational trauma for this, I like cried talking about this episode because it really hit home for me. And the idea that forgiveness is for yourself most of the time, right? Like, and that was something that like you really see, like go watch the episode already. Spoiler, at the end when the El Coco is standing there and he's like, and the main character is like, I forgive you. I don't want this. And you see how hard it is for him to reject it. And I'm brought to tears thinking about it. So, you know, there's that theme, right? And the intergenerational trauma. And there was also the relationship between the brothers, right? I thought that was very like how they were, you know, gaslighting their truth-telling brother. Like, I've often felt like a black sheep. My family will disagree with me, but I felt like a black sheep. And the idea that because you've always been this certain way, it colors how people see you. So even when you're saying something that is very true and that everybody knows, it can still be dismissed.
Well, you know what was interesting is there's one line that sticks out to me, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it too, is when the main character's older brother says to him, or basically like calls him out on having like disappeared on the family and like now that the parent is dying, that he's coming back. Mm. And I felt like that was so, I love when lines or like little pieces of dialogue ring resonant to experiences, because there is a sense, especially among Latinx families, that like if you're not at every event, if you're not going to every Christmas, if you're not going to every celebration, that like you're withdrawing from the family, and that like, and like that the family ultimately has, you know, your best interests at heart or is more understanding of you, like just like at a base level, like that's an understanding. And it's a very complicated thing, because for some people, like the family is the site of a lot of drama.
Maybe the main character is making the healthiest choice by staying away from the family because he's not inflicting more trauma on himself and others. Maybe it's really helpful to have some distance, because then you're not engaging in these like entrenched patterns, right?
Totally.
So I always love seeing something that like calls out things that we're supposed to be used to, that we're supposed to, you know, take for granted, that if you think about it, can be pretty bad, you know, like the way that they, for example, the tia, when she said tontería at him, I got so mad. Like, you know, when she called his trauma foolishness, I was like, this is so bad. This could be so worse. And you just see the heartbreak on his face. So, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I really love the Thea character because in a lot of ways also, I mean, you know, Latinx families, we love our matriarchs. And it did remind me of, once again, Encanto, because like that is, I just want to say quickly on Encanto, one of the things that I did like about it was that it was one of the first portrayals of an abuela that I saw where the abuela was wrong, or not that she's wrong, but that she kind of admitted that she could be wrong and like people, and that people took her to task for it, because often abuelas are very undercomplicated and they're just loving or they're just stubborn. And like, it was interesting to see Encanto like really be able to thread that needle of making a complicated abuela character. So in this one with the matriarch, you know, represented by Thea, I was, you know, I'm always struck by that character that is the one who feels like it's their job to keep the family together by any means necessary. So people have to, like, it's almost like, you know, there's that sense of like, well, you have to forgive each other, your family, you have to do this, your family. And like, she's very invested and wrapped up in that. And that comes from its own place of like experiences in the family, you know? And so we were just talking about walking away as a valid reaction. It's like, her reaction is valid too. And it's based in her own history and her own psychology.
Well, and so much of this episode is about like from her to what is happening with everyone's past in this family and what the father did and all of these things. It's a lot about like how we process trauma, right? And so like, what do you think this episode has to say about like the way that we process trauma?
Well, you know what's interesting? I also want to say, as a writer, I kind of resonated with the father because, you know, I'm someone who writes through trauma as well in my personal writing, less so in my professional journalistic life, but in my personal writing, like I just talked about my graphic novel, right? And there's always that sense of like, well, what are you going to write about the family? Like, what are you going to say about them? And I do think of that as like a real concern. And so for me, I felt like this episode, while it did show the journey of like the main character dealing with his trauma, did a really good job of bringing everyone's different reactions to how they process the same event to the table. So there's people who sweep it under the rug. There's people who, you know, for them, it shapes the rest of their life. And there's people who like behind the scenes are working to try to make things better. And they're never heralded. They're never given their due.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like often punished. So I think it's a thing about how, you know, one moment in time or a series of events or like one problem can actually ripple out. And I felt like the episode was really good at giving credence or giving weight and metal to everyone's reactions. I don't actually felt like it didn't. The episode was really good at not judging how people reacted to the same trauma.
Yeah, I felt the same way. It was like really powerful because you see how everybody was affected, even the, you know, like the oldest brother who was really harsh in his reaction. But then they explain how he had it harder in ways the youngest, Axel, didn't understand. And I also appreciated I'm not a middle child, but from my siblings, the middle child trying to placate everybody, that rang really true.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. My sister and I always have like the discussion about who is the favorite in the family. So I just have one older sister. And it's kind of one of those things where like the grass is always greener because she's the older and she was closer to my mother. And it was just the three of us growing up. So my, you know, to me, I felt like my sister was the favorite because my mother confided in her. And my sister was like, you got to get shielded from everything. You were like, I had to know everything that was going on. So I had that burden. So she feels like I'm the favorite because I was actually protected from like knowing all of everything that was happening.
But, you know, the monster, quote unquote, and the anger it holds on to is attached to Axel until he decides to name it and face the trauma. I think there's really something to be said for the idea of naming something to take away the toxic power that it has over not just him, but his whole family is kind of like released from it a little bit. So what do you think, how can we do this in real life? Can you solve our generational trauma in a cool 30-second soundbite?
Yeah, just give us like a 1 second.
Just help us fix everybody.
If you have time.
I'll just say.
But like, really, yeah. What do you think is a path forward to turn the same idea of like a generational inheritance from something that feels like a burden to a gift? You know.
In therapy, one of the things that I've explored, and obviously I am not a therapist, so please, if anyone's listening, speak about this with a professional and don't take what I'm saying
therapy.
As gospel.
Everybody should get therapy.
But like, we talk about, like, there are things that I am angry about that I don't even recognize. And what happens is when I talk about situations that make me angry, my therapist asks me to locate in my body where it makes me angry. Mm. And often what happens is that it actually happens in my throat to where it's hard for me to speak. Mm. And so like we actually try to locate. So instead of naming it like an external, like, oh, it's El Coco, like maybe for you who's listening, it's about working with a therapist to locate where the anger lives and like learn how to massage that, or like, and I don't mean physically, but like learn how to pay attention to where in your body your anger is sitting.
I think that's so genius. And another plug for therapy, you know, I once had a therapist be like, I'm gonna just repeat back some of the things you've said about yourself. And it's kind of like naming, right? Because it's placing it outside of yourself. And just hearing her words that were my words, it was what, like, I had just said it, but hearing it from somebody else places it outside of you in a set. You're like, oh yeah, that thing isn't, it's no longer in my brain pattern. That's something I can name and point to, is like, that doesn't necessarily have to be the truth. That's something I just said.
I have a lot of thoughts about this episode and generational trauma. I'm gonna go hold my cats now, because that is also a part of the things that my therapist says. When it's like, hey, every time something comes up about your generational trauma, hold a cat. And I'm like, I got two. Figure it out.
Matthew, this has been such a thoughtful, powerful conversation. We so appreciate you sharing. And please tell our audience where they can follow your work on the internet.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Matthew Rodriguez, and that's Matthew with one T and Rodriguez with a G and a Z.
Thank you so much, Matthew, for joining us today. Cannot wait to check out more of your work online, and you have been such an amazing guest. This was really an honor. Thank you so much.
Danielle, that was such a great conversation with Matthew Rodriguez, and a little bit verklempt now.
This episode of Two Sentence Horror Stories did the thing that this show does so well, which is be able to take all of these complex feelings and, you know, present them via horror. Like, that is what the show does so well. And I had so many feelings about the show. It really hit me in like a really specific place.
Me too.
And to be able to talk to people about this episode really meant a lot. This was really good.
Me too, because I ended this episode with like big feelings, capital, you know, capital F with big feelings, and
capital S.
And so to be able to talk about it with the people who created it, both the words, the images, and the music, as well as such a thoughtful person like Matthew, who can, you know, really dig in with us on the themes, was awesome. And Danielle, we got to talk about how cool it was to just hear Spanish in a show with no big whoop, just no translation needed, just like casual Spanish. I'm here for it. It felt so inclusive and warm and lived in. And actually, that was a hugely emotional part of it for me, too.
Like, that was one of the things in this episode that really stood out to me, was the fact that they were speaking Spanish and not treating it like it was weird or off or awkward. You know?
Exactly. And I think what's so amazing about Two Sentence Horror Stories is touches like that are put in place, and they happen because these episodes are made by creators who, as Matthew said, bring their experiences to the work. So thank you so much to Lisa Morales, Stephanie Adams Santos, Brittany Allen, and Matthew Rodriguez for today's amazing conversation. And I am going to well up, Danielle, because it's our last episode.
Gosh, I can't wait to reconnect with all of y'all next season. This is legit, like, not even because they're paying me. This is one of my favorite shows on television. And the fact that I get to talk about it with Megan and with all of these amazing creators and writers and smart-ass people who didn't necessarily take part in the episodes, but are able to lend their lens and perspective to the episodes. I feel like a kid in a candy store. So,
me too. And I'm crying as you try to drag me out the door.
I know. I literally am.
This has been so fun.
This has been so good. This has been Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast. And we'll catch you next time. Thank you for listening to Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast.
Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts so you never miss an episode.
Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast, is a Stage 13 original series hosted by me, Danielle Radford.
And me, Megan Rosati. Don't forget to watch Season 3 of Two Sentence Horror Stories on the CW and CWTV.com and stream Seasons 1 and 2 on Netflix.
Check out more on the show at stage13.com and be sure to follow Two Sentence Horror Stories on Instagram at Two Sentence Horror Stories for the latest updates on the podcast and show and on our Facebook page at Two Sentence Horror Stories to connect with other fans of the show and share your thoughts on this season.